Welcome to this week's edition of Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of news from the grassroots, news overlooked by the corporate media. On today's show, anti-nuclear activist Corbin Harney passes away, a rare 1968 interview between author Julius Lester and poet activist June Jordan, Just Healthcare and the Western Pennsylvania Coalition for Single-Payer Healthcare organize around the film Sicko, plus more in our local and global headlines.
Rust Belt Radio airs live every Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. on WRCT 88.3 FM in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and again on Tuesday mornings, 9 to 10 a.m. We're also on Pacifica affiliate WBJW Benwood 94.1 FM in the Wheeling, West Virginia area on Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. And we're on WPTS 10 to 11 a.m. on Wednesday mornings at 92.1 FM from the campus of the University of Pittsburgh. We're also available on the internet, both on WRCT's live web stream at wrct.org and for download, stream, or podcast at radio.indypgh.org. We turn now to local stories.
The Pennsylvania state budget for fiscal year 2007-2008 was supposed to be completed by July 1st. 16 days later, the budget is not complete, but some agreements have been made. The state budget deal reached July 9th will impact the Pittsburgh transit crisis. Port Authority of Allegheny County Chief Executive Steve Bland said he is cautiously optimistic that the deal will allow PAT to forego the elimination of an additional 34 routes scheduled for September. Quote, "It would allow us to not implement the September service reduction. The service out there now would be stabilized," end quote. The new transportation funding would provide $300 million to bail out deficit-ridden mass transit systems, including the Port Authority of Allegheny County. The budget deal would create a fund by making I-80 a toll road. This fund would increase to $350 million next year and $400 million in 2 years. Amanda Ziders of Save Our Transit said, quote, "It took 6 years, but they finally done something. It took the work and support of a lot of people to make this happen. They still have to finalize the vote, but everything looks good. It's exciting," end quote. Save Our Transit is an organization of transit supporters demanding reliable public funding for mass transit. Six House and Senate leaders met in a conference committee Sunday night to approve a $27.2 billion spending package for the fiscal year that began July 1st. Both chambers could vote today, Monday, July 16th. Treasury officials warn that paychecks for state workers may be delayed on Friday, July 20th, if the budget is not completed today.
The emerald ash borer, a beetle species introduced from Asia that fatally infests ash trees, has been found in Pennsylvania. The ash borer was discovered in Michigan in 2002, although it probably arrived there at least 10 years before, transported in wooden packing materials. It has almost completely eliminated ash trees in the lower peninsula of Michigan, and it has also spread extensively in Ohio and Indiana. It has been found in scattered locations in Ontario, Illinois, and Maryland. On June 21st, the beetle was discovered in Cranberry, and in response, the National Resources Conservation Service did an extensive field survey of the area. They found that hundreds of trees in northern Allegheny and Butler counties are infested. It also found strong evidence that the borers have been in the state undetected for more than a year, and they are spreading. Pennsylvania has four species of ash trees, the green, white, black, and pumpkin ash. The green and white ash are common in broadleaf forests, and the black ash is adapted to live in wetlands. Extensive stands of black ash are characteristic of many forested wetlands. While these species are widespread in eastern North America, the pumpkin ash is geographically limited to the Great Lakes region, including Erie and Crawford counties in Pennsylvania. Ash trees make up 3-5% of Pennsylvania's total forest cover. Ash trees are also commonly used in landscaping, including many areas of Pittsburgh. The ash is the latest in a series of human-introduced tree epidemics that have decimated many native tree species. Previously lost from our forests and wetlands have been the American chestnut and the American elm, while the eastern hemlock, beech, and dogwood are currently declining. The emerald ash borer kills trees within 3 to 5 years. The adults fly to new trees and lay eggs under the bark, where the larvae hatch and feed on the tree's inner bark. No control methods have been found that are both effective and environmentally safe. The adult beetles can travel only about half a mile. The rapid spread of the pest has been likely assisted by people transporting wood. To slow the borer's spread, state parks and forestry officials in Pennsylvania have now banned the transport of firewood anywhere within the state and imposed a quarantine in Butler, Allegheny, Beaver, and Lawrence counties to restrict the movement of all ash nursery stock, green lumber, and any other ash material, including logs, stumps, leaves, and wood chips. Because ash wood cannot easily be distinguished from other hardwoods, the quarantine applies to all materials that might contain ash. With the specter of near extinction at hand for ash species, the U.S. Forest Service has started a program to collect ash seeds in order to preserve examples of its genetic diversity throughout the tree's natural range. Volunteers can take part by collecting the seed and sending it to a central repository. For more information, visit emeraldashborer.info.
For more on local news, you can visit pittsburgh.indymedia.org.
You are listening to Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of news overlooked by the corporate media. We turn now to news from other independent media sources around the world.
Opposition to the war in Iraq has reached a record high, with 7 in 10 Americans calling for the withdrawal of U.S. forces, as stated in a recently released USA Today Gallup poll. Poll results also show that George W. Bush's approval rating has dropped from 33% in June down to 29%. While many Americans have voiced their own opposition through protests and public rallies, two teenagers are taking a unique approach as they make a plea for peace. Ashley Casal, age 19, and Michael Israel, age 18, are walking 3,000 miles from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. on a march for peace. Casal and Israel are using the march to promote several ideals, including nonviolent resistance, end of crimes against humanity, civil disobedience, ending nuclear weapon holding, and global citizenship. The two teenagers, who were strangers before the march began, united together after Casal made a public request for individuals that shared her vision to join her on the cross-country trek. The march began on May 21st, and the pair planned to arrive in Washington, D.C. on September 11th. Casal talked with KGNU Community Radio about the purpose of the march and being stopped as they attempted to pass through the Rocky Mountain National Park.
We're doing this walk because we feel like it's really important for people, and especially young people, to express our dissent with the war that's going on. So we're marching for peace from San Francisco to Washington, D.C.
So how many miles a day on average are you covering?
We cover pretty much usually 25 miles, sometimes a little less, or sometimes we push a little more, but 25 usually.
And where are you staying each night? Do you have accommodation reserved, or is it just wherever you end up?
We pretty much stay wherever we end up. We carry our camping gear with us, so we can camp out wherever, and often people will take us into their house when they find out what we're doing and give us a place to stay and shower.
What happened last Sunday when you tried to walk through the Rocky Mountain National Park as part of your journey?
When we arrived at the entrance gate, we had our signs on that basically just cover the extent of our shirts, and they say March for Peace, SF to DC, and our website address on the bottom, March for Peace Info. And they looked at our signs and said that they were too political and they didn't think that we could enter the park. And the ranger there at the entrance booth called another one, and they kind of hassled us for a while and took a long time to get our identification. They said we needed a permit for demonstrations, although we explained that we weren't stopping to demonstrate. We didn't have huge banners or a big sign. Basically, what we have is just covering our shirts, so it's not really any different from a T-shirt that might have a political slogan on it or something. But they really weren't very willing to explain the situation to us at all, and they weren't willing to show us any regulations that stated that the signs that we have would be not allowable. So we were kind of frustrated with the situation. And eventually we did take our signs off so that we can enter the park, but we wrote the same information onto our T-shirts so that people would still be able to see what we're doing.
And that was acceptable if you had the same slogans but just on a T-shirt?
Yeah, I mean, the one park ranger in particular who was giving us the hardest time was not at all pleased because he thought it was kind of a defiant response, but it was I guess, kind of clever on our part to realize that they can't take our T-shirts, and we were basically showing them that we had the same exact thing, you know, on our signs.
Have you gone through any other national parks or are planning to go through other national parks on your route?
I'm not sure. I don't think there are any other national parks scheduled along the way, although that would be interesting to see if we had a similar reaction.
And have you had this reaction from anywhere else? What's been the general reaction on the walk?
We really haven't had any other run-ins with law enforcement officers, and it's usually just people. You know, there's only two of us on this march, so it's not like we're a traffic disturbance or anything, and most of the people we meet driving by are really responsive and happy to see us out there. Some people honk for us, but we haven't really had any other issues.
That interview was courtesy of KGNU Community Radio's Morning Magazine in Boulder, Colorado. You can view a map of the travelers' completed route as well as their updated current location. For more information about this march and the ways that you can help, please visit www.marchforpeace.info.
Last Wednesday, anti-nuclear activist Corbin Harney passed away from cancer. Harney, an elder and spiritual leader of the Western Shoshone Nation, helped to successfully halt plans for the Divine Strike, a high-explosive test in Nevada last year. More on Harney's life and work from Christina Onestad of the Bay Area Independent Media Center.
My name's Corbin Harney. I'm born in Idaho, raised in Idaho and Nevada both, roamed the country. My people always have said to me from the beginning of my life, as I remember, to take care of what's out here, what's out there on the land. All those things we have to have ceremony for. Those are the reason why I've been trying to teach my people, not only my people, but the people that's surviving on this land, teach them we have to really start talking to the nature. Nature way of life, the only way we are going to survive here.
That was the voice of Corbin Harney, spiritual leader of the Western Shoshone Nation, who passed away from cancer. Harney had dedicated his life to fighting nuclear testing and dumping. In 1994, Harney established the Shundahai Network to respond to spiritual and environmental concerns of nuclear issues. Julianne Fischel, an attorney with the Western Shoshone Defense Project, was a colleague and friend to Harney.
Corbin was extremely involved in seeing that the Divine Strike test that was scheduled at the Nevada test site originally in 2006 was finally canceled this year. As soon as he heard about that test, which was 700 tons of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil mixture, he came to our organization, the Defense Project, and other organizations and individuals and said that the test had to be stopped. It was essential. And he put all of his spiritual energy in, as well as all of his advocacy energy in getting other people riled up to come together, to join together in a Divine Strike coalition nationwide with supporters in Europe and other areas across the world. And that test was actually canceled. So that was a real accomplishment, I think, that came about in large part due to Corbin Harney telling us how important, how essential it was the test be stopped.
Over his lifetime, Corbin Harney traveled around the world as a speaker, healer, and spiritual leader with an environmental and spiritual message. Harney also established Puhaba, a native healing center located in Tecopa Springs, California. Fischel says Harney's spiritual philosophy was to preserve traditional Shoshone ways.
His push for people to understand and to relearn traditional ways of living and to relearn traditional indigenous ways of respecting the earth and the sacred elements of the earth, and especially the water and the air. These were real core components of all of his life's work, because without the land, the air, the water, there would be no life.
Harney received numerous national and international awards and spoke before the United Nations in Geneva, Switzerland. Harney also authored two books, The Way It Is, One Water, One Air, One Earth, and a forthcoming book, The Nature Way. A public statement issued by Harney's family today says he will be missed but always honored for his work and dedication to traditional ways.
The
That was Christina Anastad of the Bay Area Independent Media Center. For more on the life of Corbin Harney, visit www.indiebay.org.
You've been listening to Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of news from the grassroots.
On Friday, June 29, 2007, Michael Moore's film Sicko opened in theaters nationwide. The film, which documents the current state of the United States healthcare system, has helped many to take notice of the growing support for a single-payer universal healthcare system. Locally, there are many organizations that endorse the national bill, H.R. 676, entitled Expanded and Improved Medicare for All. On April 17, 2007, the Allegheny County Council passed a resolution supporting the bill, joining many labor unions, religious groups, medical associations, and others. One local group, the Western Pennsylvania Coalition for Single-Payer Healthcare, has been working with lawmakers and the public to help garner support for H.R. 676 and to educate the public about a single-payer system. Rust Belt Radio spoke with two members of the coalition, Sandy Fox and Ed Grister. First, Sandy talks about the origin of the coalition and their goals.
The Western PA Coalition for Single-Payer Healthcare is a grassroots local organization, and it works with Healthcare Now, which is the national grassroots organization. The Western PA Coalition was started in the spring, winter and spring of 2006, as we were planning for a citizens' hearing on healthcare reform that was conducted at Temple Sinai in Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh, where John Conyers, Congressman John Conyers from Michigan, came to keynote that event. But we are a grassroots organization whose goals include education and advocacy for single-payer universal health care in this country. And it really is two-pronged in terms of the education and the advocacy piece, because many people don't understand what single-payer means. And there is some fear-mongering going on in this country and has been for years around that. So we need to help people understand so they're not afraid of what the concept means.
Here's Ed on single-payer healthcare and the uphill battle against the pharmaceutical and health insurance industries.
Single-payer healthcare, in a nutshell, is the replacement of the delivery of the healthcare system today. The payment of the healthcare system today is through insurance companies. There are probably over 1,000 insurance companies in the United States, some profit, some not-for-profit. Each one of them has its own set of criteria, its own administrative network and whatnot, which encompasses about 25 cents out of every insurance dollar that you pay as a premium. What H.R. 676 will do will be to replace the private for-profit-driven healthcare system with what's called a single payer. So rather than people pay, premiums to their insurance companies, they would pay a premium to a single payer, which would be like Medicare, the government. That single premium actually amounts to about 3.5% of an employee's gross salary, which for the vast, vast majority of citizens is less money than they pay in their current insurance premium. So basically, we're replacing an insurance premium that costs thousands of dollars a year with a tax on the employee and the employer, which for all intents and purposes, which you have to get into more detail, is less money than people pay now. In return, people would get no deductible, no copay insurance for all necessary health care services, including preventive care, dental care, eye care, vision care, prescription drugs. And you would get a card, and that would be, you would give it, you would go to any health care provider you would want. The health care providers would still be private, nonprofit health care providers. They wouldn't be employees of the government. So, you know, if you go into St. Margaret's Hospital or whatever hospital you went to, UPMC, Shadyside Hospital in Pittsburgh, they would still be run by their same entities. They would just be paid. The bills would be paid by the single payer. So that's what single payer is. And the chances of getting this passed at this point are not very good. And the reason that is because the healthcare industry is a very powerful entity, the prescription drug industry, pharmaceuticals, I mean, they wield tremendous power, and H.R. 676 would undercut their power. And that's pretty much what we face. We faced a big task, but what we see, though, is people are not enamored. They're not, they know they're getting ripped off. Again, what we have to do is kind of connect the dots and say, until the insurance industry is eliminated from the provision of health care, nothing is going to change. And that's why we don't see anything of good with Mr. Rendell's plan. It's just tweaking around the edges. He's essentially, you know, all the plans that most of the people are promoting as presidential candidates don't do really anything, and that's simply because they don't want to confront the power of big money. And so that's really what we face today, and I think it's becoming clear to the general public that that's the 800-pound gorilla.
The Western PA Coalition for Single Payer Healthcare and other groups have been passing out information at theaters where Sicko is shown. Again, Ed Grister.
What Sicko documents is it doesn't focus so much on the people who don't have insurance, but which is a tragedy of untold proportions, 45, 47 million, which is going up and up and up. It's interesting. There are more people today that don't have insurance after all the people and the politicians who say, we can't have a radical change like H.R. 676. We need incremental changes. We need to just have little changes around the edges. Through all that political posturing, every year the number of uninsured have gone up. So what Sicko does is doesn't focus on that. It focuses on the three-quarters or 80% of the people who actually have insurance but find out that they have high deductibles or they've met their maximum amounts of coverage, or they simply can't pay the high premiums. It's just overbearingly too expensive. So what Sicko does is it takes those people who are the average Americans and say, hey, I have insurance, everything's fine, yeah, da 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 da. And then they find out that it isn't covered for this disease, or their insurance company denies this coverage, or their doctor isn't in the network, and they get thousands and thousands of dollars of bills and whatnot. So it kind of punctures the idea that even though you have insurance, you're only one step away from either bankruptcy or perhaps not getting covered. And that's the tragedy, is almost half of personal bankruptcies today are caused by health insurance.
Sandy Fox on the current healthcare myths, learning more about a single-payer system and how to get involved.
I think people need to do their homework. They need to get educated on what we have and what we could have. There's a lot of myths out there. There are a lot of people who are afraid of going to a national health insurance system because their elected official may be talking about rationing or waiting lists and this kind of thing. Those myths need to be corrected. We certainly, and Sicko documents this very well, in this country wait a lot longer in emergency rooms for emergency room care than Canada, for example. And even to see a specialist in this country can sometimes take weeks or months. So I think that misinformation is out there, and it will continue to be generated by the interest groups that have a lot to lose under a single-payer system, specifically the insurance and pharmaceutical industries. So, you know, educating yourself on the facts is very important. We have a website, www.WPASinglePayer.org, in which we provide information on what single payer is, as well as links to other groups, including Healthcare Now, the national grassroots organization, so that people can do just that. But, you know, we also, for people who don't have access to the computer, we'll talk to people on the phone, you know, and try to answer questions. We do healthcare forums across the area. We had two this spring, one in Carrick, PA, and one in the North Hills outside of Pittsburgh at La Roche College. In September, there will be one in Butler, PA, and in the fall, there is talk about planning one for Greensburg in Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania. We also have contacts in Erie, Pennsylvania, and they're working on leafleting a theater in Erie that is showing Sicko. And when I say leafleting a theater, I mean standing outside and handing information to people so that people can start to get educated. Beyond the education, there's also the piece of advocacy. And of course, when you're working together, you have a lot more power. But even as individuals, you can still contact your representatives in Congress and the state and the U.S. senators in Congress to let them know that you want a system of health care in this country that is fiscally and socially responsible, which is what a single-payer system represents. By taking out the middleman of the insurance industry, you lower the cost and are able to provide excellent coverage to everyone. It does not discriminate based on pre-existing condition or age or gender or sexual preference or anything. It's humane, it's moral, it's ethical. And the bill in Congress right now in the House of Representatives is called H.R. 676, the U.S. National Health Insurance Act, also known as Expanded and Improved Medicare for All. It currently has 75 co-sponsors in the House, including Mike Doyle, the congressman from Pittsburgh. And it, you know, probably, of course, under our present White House administration, is not expected to be passed. But the point is to increase support for this bill in Congress so that we are setting the stage for whoever runs and, you know, for the White House, that this is an important issue to the citizens of this country. And while the insurance and pharmaceutical industries pay huge sums of money in lobbying and campaign contributions to elected officials and candidates, we ultimately have the most power because we vote. So the more we let our representatives and senators know that we want a single-payer system of health care, the more likely we are to succeed. So that is the bottom line. And we also need to let our elected officials and candidates know that we do not want them to accept contributions from the insurance and pharmaceutical industries. You know, that's an important piece of this. We want them to listen to us. The general meeting for the Western Pennsylvania Coalition for Single-Payer Healthcare is conducted once a month, and our next meeting is Tuesday night, July 24th, from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the 6th Presbyterian Church on the corner of Forbes and Murray Avenue in Squirrel Hill, Pittsburgh. And it's the Murray Avenue entrance. And anyone is invited to attend. You don't have to RSVP. You can just come. We're hoping for a large crowd in response to our leafleting, because on our leaflets we've identified this meeting as a place for people to come learn. And so we expect to do some education around single payer and H.R. 676 and talk about letter writing and contacting our representatives and senators. So, you know, I would invite anyone who's interested to please come. And again, if you visit our website, WPASinglePayerPAYER.org. There's also a listing about the meeting there. And if you want to be on our email list so you can get updates on what we're doing, there's a place on the website where you can click and ask to be put on the email list.
Just Healthcare, another local organization, works to, quote, influence public policy and to educate, empower, and mobilize citizens about the growing crisis in the U.S. healthcare system and encourage them to join and to support significant and meaningful healthcare reform, end quote. Not only does Just Healthcare support a national single-payer plan, they also support state legislation. Rust Belt Radio spoke with Brian Stagno of Just Healthcare and PUSH, Pennsylvanians United for Single-Payer Healthcare.
PUSH is the political action committee arm of a group called Just Healthcare, which started as the Thomas Merton Center Project as an advocacy group for fair and equal healthcare for all. PUSH so far has drawn up legislation with a number of different doctors and lawyers and activist leaders that have come together to write a bill for a universal health care system for the state of Pennsylvania, and through some of our action and action of similar groups across the state, the bill has been introduced in both the Pennsylvania State House and State Senate. The legislation this session is HB 1600 in the House and SB 300 in the State Senate. Both bills would set up an independent trust fund where all healthcare dollars would go towards the trust fund and then be paid out to private healthcare providers, very much the way that Medicare works for all citizens 65 years and older. The goal is to get it passed, you know, this session if possible, and if not, then keep it in action next session and try to get it passed next session. There's another part of Just Healthcare, which is the education component of it, that is trying to just educate the public at community meetings and at any other sort of event that we can get to educate people about the possibility, the option of how a single-payer healthcare system works. There's a lot of myths that are around these days and that Michael Moore addresses very well in his movie Sicko as far as the socialized medicine myth and the waiting line myth, and so educating people as to why single payer is actually a very efficient and equitable way of distributing the healthcare money is a great goal of ours.
One common myth is that Canadians come to America for treatment because their wait lines are too long for non-emergency related visits. A 2002 study published in Health Affairs Journal found that, quote, the vast majority of services provided to Canadians were emergency or urgent care, presumably coincidental with travel to the United States for other purposes. They were clearly unrelated either to advanced technologies or to waiting times north of the border. End quote. Brian Stagno.
Michael Moore's new film, Sicko, does, I think, a great job of focusing on the people who do have health care from a private insurer, or who once had health care from a private insurer and really didn't get their money's worth, to sum it up. And I think that's what's happening to a lot of people who feel like they have a comfortable amount of health insurance, who, you know, feel secure until something catastrophic happens and they wind up being, you know, dropped from their insurer, or when they lose their job and trying to buy health insurance on their own from a private insurer. You know, they're finding that the private insurers will find any reason, any excuse to prevent giving money to them, to prevent actually insuring people that need it the most. Yeah, I think it's really hard to go into this movie and watch what, very specifically, what the health insurance companies are doing, and not just get not only, you know, angry, but worried about, oh my gosh, what if I was in that situation? What if someone in my family was in that situation? I think that whenever, you know, the comfortable middle class gets very aware of the threat that the private health insurance is are to us whenever they keep restricting things and making more and more of a profit as a priority, I think that's when we're going to see real change. And I think it's, you know, Michael Moore's film is really speeding that change along, hopefully.
More from Brian Stegno.
Just Healthcare is a member-based organization. We're always looking for support and members to become active in learning more about the issues and going out and trying to inform others about the issues. We do have a website. It's www.just-healthcare.net. You can find out information there about upcoming events. The newsletter is online, and different relevant articles that come out are put up online a lot also. We encourage anyone that's interested in learning more, not only to visit our website, but to contact the group. We do have a number of people who do speaking events that can, you know, come and do a presentation on single-payer healthcare in general and on the Pennsylvania bills specifically. And anyone that's interested in setting up a talk like that for their community group or church group or anyone who's interested in listening, we'd love to come and tell people what we know about the healthcare system and what we think is important for them to know. People that are more interested beyond that can get involved with our group in going out and trying to educate others with our group. And very importantly right now, we can try to contact our state representatives and state senators and try to encourage them to co-sponsor the legislation that we do have. It's called the Family and Business Healthcare Security Act, and it is, like I said, SB 300 and HB 1600. And out of Western Pennsylvania, there's only one House rep and a few senators that have signed on so far. It was introduced by State Senator Jim Furlow, who's here in the east end of Pittsburgh. But trying to contact, you know, local representatives and local senators can have a really big influence. In my experience, I was really impressed when I, you know, decided that I learned enough about the issues that I wanted to contact some of our officials, and how little the officials really know and understand the healthcare system, and how empowering it was for me to sit down with them, explain it to them, and, you know, hear their reaction and be able to answer their questions, and, you know, over the course of a short time, really, get a couple of local officials to support the legislation that we have.
PUSH will be holding their monthly meeting on Monday, August 13th, 2007, at 6:15 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 605 Moorwood Avenue, on the corner of Moorwood and Ellsworth Avenue. The Western PA Coalition for Single-Payer Healthcare will be handing out leaflets outside of theaters showing SICO. For information on volunteering, you can contact them at sicco@wpasinglepayer.org or attend their meeting at the 6th Presbyterian Church in Squirrel Hill on the corner of Forbes and Murray, Tuesday, July 24th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. For more information about Michael Moore's film, SICO, you can visit www.michaelmoore.com/sicko.
From the Pacifica Radio Archives, we'll now hear a rare 1960 interview between author Julius Lester and poet and activist June Jordan. They discuss the political climate of the late 60s, the struggles of oppressed peoples around the world, and strategies of resistance.
I just get so angry. And I just stay angry when I think about what has been done to me, what has been done to black people, and what's done to all people, you know, because of the way this country is structured and, you know, constructed. Because it is not only inhuman, it's anti-human. Mm-hmm. And that... that this kind of situation exists, that people perpetrate this kind of system, just makes me so angry that I want some revenge for the fact that they have been so arrogant as to deprive me of the kind of life that I know people can have. So they have to pay for that.
September 1968, the voice of award-winning author Julius Lester during an interview he conducted with poet and activist June Jordan at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City. In 1968, the nation was in the middle of the civil rights struggle and the Vietnam War. This recording was done just weeks after the violence in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention. It is an emotional and disturbing moment in the interview, and it was an emotional and disturbing moment in our country's history. This is the Pacifica Radio Archives, The Sound of History. This week, we explore the archive and listen to June Jordan. This was her response to Julius Lester.
Well, see, I want to... What I would like, ideally, would be that we could all... When I say we, I mean everybody who's been put down and kept out, you know, in this country. We could get to a position where, you know, like, revenge would be a luxurious thing that we could consider, you know, action. I mean, that, in other words, there would really be a choice about it, you know, because in a way what is particularly embittering to me is that it's almost as though the only thing we can do at this point successfully is to take revenge in small ways, you know?
Yeah.
Because to do something constructive in this country, to try and change anything and make a difference for human life in this country is impossible, it seems to me, really, unless you're kidding yourself. You know, and so in a way I resent that, you know, so I have very mixed feelings about that.
Yeah,
I have feelings of enmity rather than of revenge, you know, that I walk down a street much of the time, I look at all these people and you remember all the figures you hear in the latest New York Times, this and that, and you got to say to yourself, you know, these people are your enemies, you know, that one way or another they are voting for, you know, my death.
Yeah.
Really, you know,
yeah.
And the death of all the people who never, you know, been able to live yet. And to me, it's mainly brings me to a state of extreme disgust and sadness, you know. Just,
June Jordan is the most published African-American writer in history. She burst onto the literary and political scene in the late 1960s, on the wings of the civil rights and anti-war movements. Poetry for her was a political act, and she used it to shine a light on racism, sexism, homophobia, apartheid, poverty, and U.S. foreign policy. Here she reads her poem about the 1968 Chicago Democratic National Convention.
You did a poem on Chicago, didn't you?
Yeah. It's called Christ Chicago, 1968. Devil's lullaby, the lake policeman landed, helicoptered, trite, to bray the quaver, ritual brutality, fist flatfoot, fiending, muck up, foul fomented, treacly fratricide. Preserve the children running hard behind the hopeless pigs, perverted trash, perverting rhetoric. Priorities, preserve the pigs, protect the trash, the balding, sell out, ugly, prosper, parasites to take apart America. Nail the failure, sing the gringo, gross reactionary, thumb suck, fat, insatiate, consumer, rat devouring, pledge allegiance, plan the liberated, gentle, holding flag, the blood, the soul supremacy, the swallow stars.
You also have a poem, I think you brought with you, about heart transplants.
Yeah, this one was about the very first one, very first successful heart transplant that meant that a black heart was keeping a white man alive. It's called Uhuru in the O.R. I like love anonymous more than murder incorporated, or shall we say South Africa. I like the Valentine, the heart, the power, incorruptible but failing body flowers of the world. From my death the white man takes new breath, he stands as formerly he stood, and he commands me for his good. He overlooks my land, my people, in transition, transplantation, hearts and power, beating, 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 hearts in transplantation, power in transition.
In the conversations that we've had this week, you sounded, well, rather down about just things in general, about what happened in Chicago, and just about the way things have seemed to be going in this country. And if I'm right, you know, what is it that, you know, is really making you feel this way?
Well, I think that every one of us, you know, who's witnessed Chicago probably has to recognize that what happened in Chicago was really not shocking. It was not particular to that city in any sense. You know, that we're all living in Chicago, America, and that means that we're living in a place that is, you know, it's consecrated to violence in a sense, and that this country is determined by death interests, you know. And I mean, when you just consider the Biafran crisis, for example, and the unspeakable inertia of this country, you know, vis-a-vis, you know, the Biafrans and the children there who have been dying. What can you say? You know, it's, I mean, this nation is, by my standards, it's unrecognizable as a human society at this point. It seems to me that it is a kind of animal world of technological interests and money purposes. Period. You know, and. We don't have to go to Biafra, you know, to be talking about the kind of hardness and just insensibility, you know, just unlimited insensibility. It seems to me that characterizes America now. It's just it's very hard not to really just want to get out, period, because it seems to me that all you can try to do now is so minuscule in scale, and in a way it'll have to be a kind of temporizing, you know, action that you take, because the overwhelming drift is to keep things the way they are, which is to say, to maintain really sensational injustice, you know, in every sphere, and to destroy people, you know, for whatever reasons of convenience, and to pursue interests that are not related even conceivably to the enlargement of the meaning of being alive in a happy sense, you know. I mean, you can't talk about happiness, it seems to me, in this country. You have to be some kind of a fool, you know, talk about happiness. Either it means you don't know what's going on, you know, or it means that you're so gross that you think you know what's going on, and that you have accepted the ethos of the American country, which is obviously hollow. You know, it doesn't maintain anybody. Can't satisfy anyone, really.
Radio host and author Laura Flanders, one of June Jordan's closest friends, was with her when she passed away in 2002 after a 10-year battle with breast cancer. She told Pacifica about Miss Jordan's lifelong efforts to stand up for the poor, the dispossessed, no matter the skin color, country, or sex. Here, Laura Flanders tells of Miss Jordan's feelings on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
She saw it simply, she told the truth. That was her mandate, her mission in life, to tell the truth. And in 1982, When Israeli forces invaded southern Lebanon and were bombing around the clock Beirut, and the news leaked out of the Israeli-assisted, facilitated, perhaps even ordered massacre in the refugee camps of Shatila and Sabra, she wrote a poem. She wrote several poems, but one of them, the most memorable of that moment, was an apology to the people of, to all the people of Lebanon, in which she pointed out that every explanation for the Israeli action in Lebanon had been proven to be a lie. She talked about the humanity of the Lebanese people, the Palestinians in the refugee camps, the wrongness of the bombing. She continued to write what she saw to be true, and to say, as I said before, you cannot have freedom for some and not for others. You cannot have justice for some and not for others. You cannot simply decide that some people are less human, that some people don't deserve land, water, love, health care, education, deserve their voices to be listened to. She wrote things as she saw them, but at that time, in 82, was no comfortable time to be speaking out for Palestinian rights or for Palestinian people or for saying, we, the Palestinians. It was not a phrase that you heard or didn't pay a price for articulating. She paid a price. I think she believed, and others would confirm this, that her role, which at that point had been to be a regular contributor to some of this country's mainstream newspapers, the New York Times, to name just one, her role was suddenly shifted into becoming a kind of outsider, somebody who was no longer welcome on the op-ed pages, somebody who had to struggle to get her books the kind of attention and respect that they deserved. 28 books. And yet when she offered to speak out about the Gulf War, when she offered her opinions on the U.S. war now against Afghanistan, she was not welcome on the op-ed pages. And I think that her career was absolutely affected by her forthright, adamant stand for equal rights for everybody against supremacist thinking of all kinds. But she was still, her last piece that she wrote for the Book of Essays, Some of Us Did Not Die, is about Israel-Palestine, is about the killing of Danny Pearl, is about the dangers of anti-Semitism and of anti-Islamic thinking in this country. She was adamantly concerned with this issue until her death.
The Preservation and Access Project is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Recording Academy, supporters of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and listeners to Pacifica Radio stations in New York City, Washington, D.C., Berkeley, California, Los Angeles, California, and Houston, Texas.
Abby Hoffman,
Muhammad Ali, Stephen Biko,
Joan Baez,
Maya Angelou,
Lawrence Ferlinghetti,
Dolores Huerta,
Medea Benjamin.
These are the voices of the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Harvey Milk,
Timothy Leary,
Orson Welles,
Dorothy Parker.
Pacifica Radio Archives, the oldest collection of public radio programming in the United States.
Lena Horne,
Erica Jong,
Martin Luther King,
Ayn Rand,
Ellen Ginsberg,
Francis Ford Coppola,
Anna Deavere Smith,
Christopher Isherwood,
Studs Terkel,
Mumia Abu-Jamal.
For more information about these and other recordings, visit www.pacificaradioarchives.org or call 1-800-735-0230. I'm Brian DeShazer, Director of the Pacifica Radio Archive.
Studs Terkel.
Lenny Bruce.
Maxine Hong Kingston.
Archbishop Oscar Romero.
Audre Lorde.
That was the Pacifica Radio Archives recording of an interview with poet and activist June Jordan and author Julius Lester. This piece was hosted by Brian DeShazer and engineered by Christopher Sprinkle. For more information on this and other archival pieces, you can contact Pacifica at 1-800-735-0230.
And now we present the IndyMedia calendar of events. On Tuesday, the 17th at 8 p.m., Rust Belt Radio will offer our monthly training in audio production. We will give a technical skills workshop on digital audio equipment, field recording, and audio editing software. This will take place at the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's office on the third floor of the Thomas Merton Center, 5125 Penn Avenue in Garfield. For more information, go to workshops.indypgh.org or call 412-923-3000.
On Wednesday the 18th, the Mon Valley Unemployed Committee is holding a community forum on healthcare for people to learn more about the significant changes to Pennsylvania's healthcare system. This event will be held from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. at the United Steelworkers Building, first floor conference room at the corner of Stanwix and Boulevard of the Allies downtown. To RSVP for the event, please contact the Mon Valley Unemployed Committee at 412-462-9962.
On Thursday the 19th from 6 to 8 p.m., retired Ambassador Lawrence Rawson, the Senior International Coordinator for the Save Darfur Coalition, will be speaking on Stopping Genocide in Darfur at St. Benedict the Moor Catholic Church, 91 Crawford Street and Center Avenue in the Hill District.
Also on Thursday the 19th at 7 p.m., join Animal Freedom and VFA for a discussion on connecting our diets to social justice. Learn about the often overlooked role food plays in shaping our societies and how diets can be tools to resist oppression. Breeze Harper will be the featured speaker. This event will be held at David Lawrence Hall, room 121 at the University of Pittsburgh in Oakland. For more information, go to www.animalfreedom.info or call 412-421-4586.
Thanks for tuning in to Rust Belt Radio here on WRCT Pittsburgh, WVJW Benwood, and WPTS Pittsburgh. Our hosts this week are Diane Amdor and Carlin Christie, with additional contributions from Jessica McPherson, Phil Cresswell, Vani Natarajan, and Veronica Milliner. This week's show is produced by Phil Cresswell and Donald Dealey. Special thanks to all of our hosts, producers, and contributors.
You can get involved with Rust Belt Radio. To contact us or send us your comments, email radio at indypgh.org. All of our shows are available for download or podcast on our website at radio.indypgh.org. And this show can be heard again Tuesday morning on WRCT at 9 a.m. after Democracy Now! Tune in next week at this time for another edition of Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of news from the grassroots. Rust Belt Radio comes from a Sprout Fund Seed Award.
This has been a production of the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center and WRCT Public Affairs. The opinions contained within are those of the participants. Questions and comments may be sent by email to pa@wrct.org, by postal mail at WRCT, 5000 Forbes Avenue, Pittsburgh, PA 15213, or by calling 412-621-0728.